Chapter 25. March 17th, 3:33 p.m. Astrakhan, Russia. As promised, Misha reached the outskirts of Astrakhan by the afternoon. With the sub still submerged, he announced this quietly to Tucker, who squeezed into the cockpit. They studied the nautical chart together. Checking coordinates, Tucker tapped a spot where the Volga's main channel branched into Astrakhan.
"Stop there?" Misha asked.
"Turn there," Tucker corrected. "Follow it for 3 miles, then call me again." It took 40 minutes to reach the branch. Tucker returned to the cockpit and pointed to another spot, a mile farther west.
"You are being very cagey," Misha said. "I see a small cove. Is that our destination?"
"No. Call me when you reach the next waypoint." After another 20 minutes, Misha summoned him again. With a smile, Tucker placed his finger on the small cove that Misha had mentioned before.
"That's our destination."
"But you said..." "Oh, I see. You are very untrusting."
"It's a recent development. Don't take it personally." "How long until nightfall?"
"To be safe, 2 hours. I will pull us into the undergrowth along this bank. It should shield us further as we wait."
It turned out to be the longest 2 hours of his life. The others attempted to question him about what he was doing, but he only gave cryptic reassurances, allowing them still to believe the sub was parked underwater at some destination near Volgograd. Finally, he ordered everyone to collect their belongings and disembark. With Tucker directing, they gathered in a clump of bushes on the shore of the cove. Overhead, the dark sky hung with low clouds, turning the waning moon into a pale disk. Aside from the trilling of insects and the occasional croak of a frog, all was quiet. Across the cove, a few hundred yards off, a trio of squat cabins hugged the water. A lone light burned beside the door of one. Moored to its dock floated a pair of small seaplanes. That was their ticket out of here.
"This is not Volgograd," Utkin whispered, scrunching his face. "The air smells too clean."
Tucker ignored him and joined Misha alongside the sub. The two shook hands.
"This is where we say goodbye," Misha said.
He let go of Tucker's hand, but continued to hold out his open palm. With a smile, Tucker understood. He pulled a wad of rubles from his pocket and counted out what he owed the sub's pilot. Then he added an extra 10,000 on top of that.
"Hazardous duty pay." "I knew I liked you for a reason, my friend."
"You'll be able to get back to Volgograd safely?"
"Yes, I think so. And I hope you do the same, wherever you are going."
"I hope so, too.
Because of the extra pay, I will wait here until you take off, just in case you need me again."
"Thank you, Misha. If I don't see you again, safe sailing." With Tucker in the lead and Kane bringing up the rear, the group headed around the curve of the cove, sticking to the trees and taller bushes. Once near the cluster of cabins, he called a halt, knelt by Kane, and pointed forward.
"Scout and return."
Kane skulked off and disappeared into the darkness. Several minutes passed. Then, from back the way they'd come, a whispered call reached him.
"Tucker!"
It was Misha. His heart thudding with worry, Tucker told the others to stay out of sight. He made his way back down the trail to where Misha was crouching.
"What is it?"
"This."
He passed over a black plastic object roughly the size and shape of a narrow bar of soap. A pair of insulated wires dangled from either side, ending in alligator clips. Misha explained,
"I was cleaning up after you left, straightening and doing a systems check while I waited as promised.
I found this tucked beneath my seat in the cockpit. Those clips had been spliced into the sub's antenna feed."
"It's a signal generator,"
Tucker muttered, his belly turning to ice. It sends out frequency-specific pulses at regular intervals.
Like a homing beacon.
Yes. Tucker felt icy fingers of despair close around his heart. That's how the enemy was tracking us. He remembered Misha describing how he would surface the sub at regular intervals to get a GPS fix on their location, especially as they neared one of their ports of call. Each time he did it, the generator gave away their location, allowing the enemy ample time to set up an ambush once they figured out Misha's routine.
"Who put it there?" Misha asked.
Tucker glanced toward the trio hidden by the cabins. Who indeed? He ran everything he knew through his head. Then his whole body clenched with a realization. It couldn't be. Misha read his reaction.
"You know who the traitor is?"
"I think so." Tucker stuffed the signal generator into his pocket. "I suggest you shove off right now and put as much distance between you and us as possible."
"Understood. Good luck, my friend."
Tucker returned to where the group sat crouched in the darkness. By now, Kane was waiting for him. The shepherd's posture, the tilt of his ears, and the softness of his eyes told Tucker all was clear. Like hell it was. He crouched and draped an arm around Kane's neck, struggling to keep his composure. Now what? How much information had already been funneled to General Harzin? Since surfacing here, he had to assume the enemy knew where they had stopped. Surely Felice was on her way. He didn't have the time to properly interrogate and break the traitor. That would come later. For now, by hiding his knowledge, he still had a slight upper hand. He stared toward the seaplanes. The enemy didn't want to kill Bukolov, and with their agent sitting next to him on the plane, they'd be even less likely to try to shoot the craft down once it was airborne. In that way, both men could serve as unwitting human shields, increasing the group's chances of reaching the rendezvous point safely. But first, he had to get them all into the air. He also intended to keep a close eye on the traitor, an eye sharper than his own. He shifted next to Kane. Shielding his hand signals, he pointed and touched the corner of his own eye. "Keep a watch on the target." Until Tucker lifted the order, the shepherd would be on close guard, watching his target for any aggressive movements or hostile actions, judging the tone of voice, listening for the cock of a hammer or the slip of a blade from a sheath. It was a broad tool, but Tucker trusted the shepherd's instinct. If his target made the wrong move, Kane would immediately attack.
"What was that all about with Misha?"
Anya whispered, drawing back his attention.
"He wanted more money, to stay silent."
"And you paid him?"
Bukolov asked, aghast.
"It was easier than killing him. And besides, we're leaving now anyway."
Tucker stood up and gestured for the others to remain hidden. He crossed to the lighted cabin and knocked on the door. It opened a few moments later. Yellow light spilled forth, framing a young woman in denim overalls. She was barely 5 feet tall, with black hair trimmed in a pixie haircut. Tucker tightened his grip on the magnum concealed in his pocket, bracing himself for any attack.
"You are Bartok?"
she asked in a surprisingly bold voice for such a small body. Bartok? He was momentarily confused until he remembered Harper's mention of a code name.
"Yes, I'm Bartok."
"I am Elena. How many come with you on plane? Cost 3,000 rubles per passenger."
She certainly didn't waste any time getting down to business.
"Four and a dog."
"Dog cost more."
"Why?"
"He crap. I must clean up, no?"
Tucker wasn't about to argue, not with this little firebrand. She sort of scared him.
"Fine.
Get others," she ordered him. "The plane is prepared. We are ready to leave."
With that, she stalked toward the dock area. Tucker waved the others out of hiding and hurried to keep up with Elena. She had stopped beside one of the planes. With one leg leaning on a float, she unlatched the side door and lowered it like a ramp onto the dock's walkway. The twin-engine seaplane, painted azure, stretched about 70 feet long, with gull wings and oval stabilizers at the tail. The fuselage was deep-chested, with a bulbous cockpit. "I don't recognize this model," he said as he joined her. She explained proudly, her hands on her hips.
"This is a Berry of BE-6. Your NATO called it Madge. Built the same year Stalin died."
"That's 60 years ago," Anya noted, worried.
59,
Elena shot back, offended.
"She is old, but a very tough bird. Well maintained. Board, now."
No one dared disobey. Once everyone was aboard, Elena unhooked the lines from their cleats, hopped inside, and pulled the door closed behind her with a resounding slam. She hurried forward to the cockpit.
"Sit down," she yelled back. "Seat belts."
And that was the extent of their pre-flight safety briefing. Bukalov and Anya were buckled into the bench along the right side of the fuselage. Utkin and Tucker on the left. Kane curled up between Tucker's feet, never letting his guard down. The plane began drifting sideways from the dock. Bukalov called over,
"Tucker, you seem to have a proclivity for unorthodox methods of travel."
"One of my many idiosyncrasies."
"Then I assume we will be traveling to the United States aboard a Zeppelin?"
"Let's leave it as a surprise," he replied.
From the cockpit came a series of beeps and buzzes, accompanied by a short curse from Elena. Then the sound of a fist striking something solid. Suddenly, the engines roared to life, rumbling the fuselage.
"Here we go,"
Elena called. The plane accelerated out of the cove and into the inlet. Moments later, they were airborne. 7:44 p.m.
"Bartok,"
Elena yelled once they had reached cruising altitude.
"You come up here."
Tucker unbuckled his seatbelt, scooted around Kane, and ducked into the cockpit. He knelt beside her seat. The co-pilot seat was empty. Through the windscreen, he saw only blackness.
"Now, tell me the destination. The person on phone said southeast, said you would have the destination once in air."
Tucker gave her the coordinates, which she jotted on her kneeboard. After a few fast calculations, she said,
50 minutes. You know what we are looking for? A signal of some kind, da? The Caspian is big, especially at night."
"Once we are there, I'll let you know."
Tucker returned to the cabin. The roar of the engines had faded to a low drone. Aside from the occasional lurch as Elena hit a pocket of turbulence, the ride was smooth. "Now is as good a time as any." Tucker stood between the two benches.
"It is time we have a family meeting."
"A what?"
Bukalov asked. Tucker dove in.
"Every step of the way, General Harzin has been waiting for us. Until now, I had no idea how he was doing it."
Tucker paused to look at each of them in turn. Anya shifted under his scrutiny.
"And? What are you saying, Tucker?"
He drew the signal generator from his pocket and held it up for everyone to see.
"What is that?" Bukalov asked, motioning for a closer look.
Tucker turned to Utkin.
"Would you like to explain?"
The young man shrugged, shook his head.
"It's a signal generator, a homing beacon. It was attached to the Olga's antenna feed. Since we left Volgograd, it's been regularly sending out a signal until I disarmed it a few minutes ago. A signal that Harzin has been listening for."
"You think one of us put it there?"
Utkin asked.
"Yes."
"It could have been Misha," Anya offered. "He would know how to attach the device. It was his submarine."
"No. Misha brought this to me.
Anya's eyes grew rounder.
Tucker, you're scaring me. What do you know?
Tucker turned to Utkin.
Is that your bag under your seat?
Yes.
Pull it out.
Okay. Why?
Pull it out.
Utkin did so.
Show me your playing cards.
My what? I don't see why.
Show me.
Having noted the hardness of Tucker's tone, Kane stood up and fixed his gaze on Utkin.
Tucker, my friend, what is going on? I do not understand, but fine, I will show you.
He unzipped his duffel and began rummaging around. After a few seconds, he froze, glanced up at Tucker, and pulled out his two boxes of playing cards, one empty, one full. Utkin held up the empty one. Tucker read the understanding in the young man's eyes.
But it is not mine,
Utkin stammered. Tucker grabbed the box, slid the signal generator into it, and resealed the flap. It was a perfect fit. Earlier this morning, during his search of the group's belongings, he'd found the empty box of playing cards in the young man's duffel. Utkin continued shaking his head.
No, no, that is not mine.
Anya covered her mouth.
Is it true? Asked Pukalov. Tucker, is this true? Ask him.
Pukalov had paled with shock.
Utkin, after all our time together, you would do this?
Why?
Is this tied to that past gambling problem of yours? I thought you had stopped.
Shame blushed Utkin's face to a dark crimson.
No, this is all a mistake.
He turned to Tucker, his eyes hopeless with despair.
What will you do to me?
Before he could respond, Anya blurted out,
Tucker, do not kill him, please. He made the mistake. Perhaps someone forced him to do it. Remember, I know these people. Perhaps they blackmailed him. Isn't that right, Utkin? You had no choice. Tucker, he had no choice.
Tucker turned to Pukalov.
Doctor, how do you vote?
Pukalov shook his head. Without looking at his lab assistant, he waved a dismissive hand.
I do not care. He is dead to me either way.
At this, Utkin broke down. He curled himself into a ball, his head touching his knees, and started sobbing. Tucker felt sorry for Utkin, but he kept his face impassive. The lab assistant had almost cost them their lives, and he might still. Felice could already be on her way here. That fear drew him back to the cockpit, leaving Utkin guarded by Kane.
Can we circle? He asked Elena. To check our tail?
She frowned at him.
You think we are being followed?
Can you do it? Elena sighed.
200 rubles extra for fuel.
Deal.
Okay, okay. Hold on.
She turned the wheel, and the barrier eased into a gentle bank. After a lazy 10-minute circle above the Volga Delta, Elena said,
I see no one. Easy to spot in the dark, but I will keep watching.
Me too.
Tucker took the empty co-pilot's seat. In the green glow of the instruments, he glimpsed a dark shape against the lower console between the seats. It was a machine gun, attached to the console with Velcro straps. It had a wooden stock and a stubby barrel. Just ahead of the trigger guard was a large cylindrical magazine.
Is that an old Tommy gun? He asked.
Elena corrected him.
That is a Spagan machine gun from Great Patriotic War. It was my father's. American gangsters stole the design.
You're an interesting woman, Elena.
Da, I know,
she replied with a confident smile.
But don't get any ideas. I have a boyfriend. Okay, 3 boyfriends. But they don't know about each other, so it's okay.
As they neared their destination coordinates, everything still remained dark and quiet in the skies around them.
What now, Bartok?
Elena asked. An island lies dead ahead at the coordinates I gave you. We're supposed to rendezvous on the eastern side, where there is a narrow beach. Once you land on the water, taxi in as close as you can, and we'll wade ashore. After that, you're done.
Whatever you say. Best to strap in now. Touchdown in 2 minutes.
Tucker relayed the message to the others, then buckled in next to Elena.
Beginning descent, she said.
The nose of the plane dipped, aiming for the dark waters below. As they plummeted, Elena prepared for landing, flipping switches, adjusting elevator controls, tweaking the throttle. Finally, the plane straightened, racing over the water until the pontoons kissed the surface. The Bereav shook slightly, bounced once, then settled. The seaplane's speed rapidly bled off, and the ride smoothed out. Tucker checked his watch. They had made good time and were 20 minutes early.
Very shallow here,
Elena announced as she swung the plane's nose and headed toward the island's shore.
Again, just get as close as you can.
Tucker unbuckled and stood up.
Thanks for the ride.
Over Elena's shoulder, out the side window, a dark shape appeared out of nowhere. Disoriented, Tucker's first thought was rock. They were passing some storm-beaten shoal sticking out of the water. Then a strobe of navigation lights bloomed, hovering there, revealing its true nature. Helicopter. Tucker shouted, Elena, get down!
What?
As she turned toward him, her forehead disappeared in a cloud of red mist. Chapter 26, March 17th, 8:47 p.m., the Caspian Sea. Tucker dropped to his knees, then his belly. He felt wet warmth dripping down his face and swiped his hand across it. Blood. He turned his head and yelled through the cockpit door.
Everyone, flat on the deck!
Kane came slinking toward him, but Tucker held up his hand, and the shepherd stopped.
What's happening?
Anya called out, sounding terrified.
The pilot's dead. We've got company.
He rolled and rose to his knees behind the pilot's seat. He craned his neck over Elena's slumped body and peeked out the side window. The helicopter was gone. Smart, Felice. Kill the pilot and the plane's grounded. Now she and her team could take their sweet time at capturing or killing them. Tucker peered through the windscreen. 100 yards ahead, the black silhouette of the island blotted out the stars. At its base, a gentle crescent of white sand beckoned. Only then did he note that the Bereav was still moving toward their goal. He scanned the control panel, looking for... There. The pictogram of a spinning propeller glowed, bracketed by a plus and minus sign. Easy enough to interpret. Reaching around the seat, he shoved the twin throttles forward. The engines roared, and the nose lifted slightly, then settled as the Bereav's speed climbed. The plane raced for the island, skimming the water, rapidly closing the distance. He knew they would never be able to escape the more agile chopper by air. That wasn't his plan. He goosed the wheel, keeping them angled toward the beach.
Brace for impact, he shouted. Kane, come!
The shepherd sprinted forward. Tucker curled his left arm around Kane's chest and turned them both so they were tucked against the bulkhead. He propped his legs against the pilot's chair and squeezed his eyes shut. Beneath his rear end, the Bereav's fuselage shuddered as it passed the shallows. Next came a shriek, followed by a grinding of metal on sand. The plane violently lurched left, catching a pontoon on something, a rock, a sandbar, then flipped up on its nose and cartwheeled across the beach. Glass shattered. From the cabin, screams and shouts. The co-pilot's seat tore free and seemed to float in midair before crashing into the side window above Tucker's head. Then the plane hit the trees, shearing off one wing. They slammed to a teetering stop. The plane stuck up on its side, the remaining wing pointed to the sky. Tucker looked around. A pair of emergency lights in the overhead bathed the cockpit in a dull glow. Tree branches jutted through the side window. Above him, over his left shoulder, he saw a sliver of dark sky through the windscreen. He took personal inventory of his condition and ran his hands over Kane's flanks and limbs, getting a reassuring lick in return. "Think," he commanded himself. Felice was still out there, but her helicopter lacked pontoons, so it could not land in the water. He pictured the tree-lined beach. He didn't believe it was wide enough to accommodate the chopper's rotor span. "We have time, but not much. They just had to survive until the plane Harper sent got here." He called.
"Everyone okay back there?"
Silence.
"Answer me."
Bukalov called weakly.
We are hanging in the air, Anya and myself. She hurt her hand.
Utkin?
I am here, pinned under my seat.
No one move. Let me come to you."
Tucker ordered Kane to stay put and pulled himself to the cockpit door. He swung his legs until he was sitting on the door combing. With the plane on its side, the left bulkhead was now the floor. He found an emergency flashlight strapped to the wall. He snagged it free, turned it on, and took a moment to orient himself. Utkin was still buckled into his seat, but it had broken loose and rolled atop him. Above him, Bukalov and Anya were strapped in place and suspended in midair. No one seemed to be direly injured, except Anya clutched her hand to her chest, her eyes raw with pain. For now, there was nothing he could do to help her.
"Utkin, unbuckle yourself and crawl to me."
As he did so, Tucker hopped down next to him and stoop-walked aft until he was beneath Bukalov and Anya. He shined his flashlight up.
"Anya, you first. Press the buckle release with your good hand and I'll catch you. It's not as high as it seems."
After a moment's hesitation, she hit the release and fell. Tucker caught her and lowered her to her feet. He repeated the procedure with Bukalov. Once down, the doctor leveled a finger at Utkin's face.
You almost got us killed. Again.
"Abram, I did not..."
"Quiet," Tucker barked. "We have only a few minutes before Felice finds a way to reach us. We need to get out of here without being seen."
"How?"
Anya asked, wincing. It appeared she had either sprained or broken her wrist.
"A window in the cockpit is smashed. That's our way out."
He turned and clambered back through the door that led to the cockpit. He swung his legs until he was straddling the combing.
"Grab our packs," he ordered. "Then Anya up first."
Moving quickly, Tucker shuttled everyone out of the cabin, past the cockpit, and through the broken window. It was a tight squeeze amid the broken branches, but it allowed them to exit directly into dense forest, keeping off the open beach. Utkin was the last of the three to leave. He looked at Tucker.
"You're wrong about me. I wish you would believe that."
"I wish I could."
As the man shimmied out, Tucker turned to Kane.
"Ready to go, pal?"
Kane wagged his tail and belly crawled after the others. Tucker followed, but not before grabbing Elena's Spagen machine gun. He slung it across his back while staring down at the young woman's lifeless body.
"I'm sorry."
The words sounded idiotic to him.
"I'm sorry you're dead. I'm sorry I dragged you into this."
Anger stabbed into him, fiery and fierce. He used it to steady the edge of panic, to clear his head to a crystal focus.
"Felice, you're dead."
He made a silent oath to make that happen. "For Elena."
Turning away, he crawled out and joined the others huddled together in the darkness of the forest.
The neighboring beach looked like polished silver under the moonlight that pierced the clouds.
"What now?" Bukalov asked. "I don't see the helicopter. Perhaps they think we are dead."
It's possible, but you're their prize, Doctor. They won't leave without knowing your true fate.
What about your people?
Anya asked. He checked his watch. It was still a few minutes until they were supposed to arrive. Tucker dug through his duffel until his fingers touched the satellite phone. Even without looking, he knew the phone was shattered. The casing had split open, and the innards lay in pieces at the bottom of his pack. "Stay here," he ordered, and crawled to the edge of the sand. He scanned the sky while straining to listen. He thought he heard the distant thump of rotors, but when he turned his head, the sound faded. Options, Tucker thought. What do we do? Felice had them pinned down. Again, Tucker heard thumping. The helicopter was definitely out there, moving with no lights like before, lying in wait. And not just for us, he suddenly realized. No wonder she didn't immediately come after them. He pushed back to the others.
Karzine knows this is the rendezvous point, that others must be coming. Felice is out there waiting for them, intending to take them out, to catch them off guard like she did us, leaving her free to deal with us after that.
What are we going to do?
Anya said.
I don't know.
Utkin suddenly bolted past Tucker, his heels kicking up sand as he broke from cover and stumbled out onto the open beach. Tucker's first instinct was to raise the Spagen, but he stopped himself. He still couldn't shoot an unarmed man in the back.
Stop! He called out to Utkin. There's nowhere to run!
A strobe of navigation lights burst above the treetops at the northern tip of the island. A floodlight bloomed, stabbing down to the beach. The helicopter's nose followed the beam down, picking up speed. Utkin got caught in the light, sliding to a stop. He lifted his arm against its blinding glare and waved his other arm.
What is that idiot doing? Bukalov said. Does he think they'll pick him up?
He'll get away,
Anya cried. Skimming the trees, the chopper reached the beach in seconds and banked over the crashed barrier. All the while, the floodlight kept Utkin pinned down. Suddenly, fire winked from the chopper's open cabin door. Bursts of sand kicked up, and a bullet struck Utkin's leg. He toppled forward, lay for a stunned moment, then started crawling in agony toward the trees, pushing with his good leg. The gun flashed again from the helicopter's doorway. A second bullet struck Utkin's other leg. He pitched flat to the sand. His arms paddled as he tried to push himself back up. From the precision of the shooting, it had to be Felice. He knew what she was doing, torturing Utkin to draw him out. She didn't know that the traitor had been exposed, or maybe she didn't care. A part of Tucker knew Utkin had brought this upon himself, but another part railed against such brutality. He felt his ears pop. A rush of hot air. The screams of his fellow rangers filled his head. He saw a mirage of a limping dog, bloodied and in pain. No, not again. Never again. He broke from cover, sprinted past the wreckage of the barrier and across the sands. He charged forward, eating up the distance until he was 20 yards away. He dropped to one knee, jerked the Spagen to his shoulder, and took aim. He fired a short 3-round burst. The Spagen bucked in his grip. The bullets went wide. He tucked the weapon tighter to his shoulder and fired again, squeezing and holding fast. Bullets shredded into the chopper's tail. Smoke gushed. The helicopter pivoted, exposing its open doorway. A lone figure stood there. Though her lower face was hidden behind a scarf, he knew it was Felice. He opened fire again, stitching the fuselage from tail to nose. She stumbled out of view. Abruptly, the chopper banked hard left and dove for the ocean's surface and picked up speed, heading away, trailing oily smoke. Furious, blind with rage, he kept firing after it until it had vanished into the darkness. Critically damaged, the helicopter wouldn't be returning any time soon. He swung over to Utkin, dropping to his knees beside him. During the firefight, the young man had managed to roll onto his back. His left thigh was black with blood. His right poured a crimson stain into the sand, spurting from his leg with a brightness that could only be arterial. Tucker pressed his palm against the wound and leaned on it. Utkin groaned heavily. One hand rose to touch the hot barrel of the machine gun.
No, you could do it.
Quiet. Lay still.
Someone had to flush out that evil Suka before she ambushed your friends.
Hot blood welled through his fingers. A sob rose in Tucker's chest, escaping in shaking gasps.
Hold on. Just hold on.
Utkin's eyes found his face.
Tucker, I'm sorry, my friend.
Then he was gone. 9:02 p.m. Tucker sat on the sand, hugging his knees. Kane lay tight against his side, sensing his grief. A small fire burned on the beach, created by igniting driftwood with some of the leaking fuel from the wreckage, a signal to those who were coming. It seemed to have worked. The drone of an engine echoed over the water. A moment later, a seaplane swept above the beach. Anya waved with her good arm. From the plane's side window, a flashlight blinked back at her, signaling the identity of their rescuers. As the plane circled for a water landing, Bukalov wandered over to him.
I still don't understand why he did that.
Off to the side, Utkin's body was covered by a tarp.
Redemption, Tucker said. I think he purposefully drew the chopper out of hiding, so I'd have a chance to take it out before the others arrived.
But why? Did he do it out of guilt?
Tucker remembered his last words. My friend. Tucker laid a hand on Kane's side.
He did it out of friendship.
Part 3. Rough Country. Chapter 27. March 18th, 8 a.m. Istanbul, Turkey. Tucker followed the embassy aide into the conference room. The space looked ordinary enough. White walls, burgundy carpet, maple table. Someone had set out glasses and pitchers of ice. He also smelled coffee, one of life's necessities at this early hour after such a long night. Bukalov and Anya joined him as he settled into one of the leather chairs. They all squeaked heavily into place for this private meeting. Anya's left arm was in a cast from mid-forearm to her knuckles. She had broken two bones in her wrist as a result of the plane crash. Her eyes were still glassy from pain relievers. For this meeting, it would just be the three of them, seated around a speakerphone. "Your call is being routed," said the aide. A young man in a crisp suit. He promptly left, sealing the door behind him. Despite the unassuming decor, Tucker knew this room in the U.S. consulate was soundproofed and electronically secure. No one else would be listening in. Tucker stared across the table at the other two. Anya looked haunted. Bukalov defeated. They'd flown straight from the Caspian Sea to Turkey, arriving well after midnight. They'd been given rooms here, but it looked like none of them had slept well. Tucker had left Kane behind to give the shepherd some extra downtime. The conference phone on the table trilled, and a voice came over the speaker. "Your party is on the line. Go ahead." After a series of beeps, followed by a burst of static, Ruth Harper's voice came on the line.
"Tucker, are you there?"
"Yes."
Again, he felt the comfort of her familiar soft twang. "I have Dr. Bukalov and Anya here also."
"Very good."
In Harper's usual brusque manner, she got right down to business.
"Let's start with the most pressing concern of the moment, Stanimir Utkin. How much information do you believe this mole shared with his superiors, with this General Artur Harzin?"
Tucker had already given Harper a condensed version of the last 24 hours, including the betrayal and ultimate redemption by Utkin. Bukalov answered angrily,
"How much information? How about all of it? He had access to all my research material. I never suspected him in the slightest."
He glanced over to Anya, his voice dropping further into defeat.
"I never suspected anyone."
Tucker stared between them. Anya looked down at the table.
"I told Abram last night about my involvement with Russian SVR, about my assignment. I thought he should hear it from me first."
"Anya Avarin," Bukalov muttered. "I didn't even know your real name."
Harper spoke into the awkward silence that followed.
"I made some discreet inquiries. As far as I can tell, Anya's story checks out. She was falsifying intelligence to her superiors."
Anya glanced to the doctor.
"In order to protect you, Abram, to protect your research, so it wouldn't be abused."
She reached her right hand to him.
"I'm sorry. I should have told you sooner."
Bukalov turned slightly away from her.
"Does she need to be here? She's of no use to me now. I have all of the clerk's diary. I can handle the rest on my own."
"Not your decision to make, doctor," Tucker replied.
"Not my decision. How can you say that? She betrayed me."
Anya said,
"Abram, please. I gave them nothing of your work. I protected—"
"I am done with you. Mr. Wayne, I refuse to allow her to accompany us."
Harper cleared her throat.
"Let's put a pin in this, doctor, and get back to Stanimir Utkin. For now, we must assume he gave Hazin everything, including the information from Palos de Klerk's diary. Is that correct, Dr. Bukalov?"
"Unfortunately, yes."
"Then let's move on to the threat posed by that information, about the danger of Luka falling into the hands of Hazin."
Bukalov took on a defensive tone.
"You must understand that if handled properly, Luka could be an unprecedented boon to humanity. We could turn deserts into—"
"Yes, I understand that,"
Harper said, cutting him off.
"But it's the phrase, handled properly, that worries me. Correct me if I'm wrong, but even if we're able to find a viable specimen of Luka, we still have no way of controlling it. Not you, not Hazin's people. Is that right?"
Bukalov hesitated, frowned.
"Yes," he said slowly. "No one has developed a kill switch, but I am convinced the mechanism for controlling Luka does exist. So is Hazin convinced. The general would only have to introduce a few ounces of Luka in a handful of strategic locations, and without a kill switch in our possession, the organism would spread like wildfire, destroying all native plant life. There would be no stopping it. But the larger threat is weaponization."
"Explain, doctor," said Harper.
"Take smallpox, for example. It's one of the most feared biological weapons known to man. But that threat alone is not enough. To be sure of infecting the maximum number of victims, smallpox must be weaponized. It must be deliverable over a wide area in a short period of time, so it overwhelms the population and the medical infrastructure. Hazin will see Luka in the same light. He's a military man, it's how they think. Weaponized Luka, delivered strategically, could reach critical mass in hours. Yes, yes, Luka in its raw form is dangerous, but not necessarily catastrophic. There would be a chance we might be able to stop it. If he weaponizes it, it's an endgame move."
"And?" Harper asked.
"As in, end of the world?"
"Without the kill switch, a way of controlling what's unleashed? Yes. We're talking about the fundamental destruction of the Earth's ecosystem."
Harper paused, digesting the information. Tucker pictured her removing her thick set of librarian glasses and rubbing her eyes. Finally, she spoke again.
How confident are you about this kill switch, Doctor?
I'm sure I can develop it. Even the clerk hinted at the possibility in his diary. I just need a sample.
From some lost cave in South Africa?
Harper added.
Yes.
And you think you can find this cave?
I believe so. Before I burned the page that explained its location, I set it to memory. But the clerk plainly feared this organism, even bestowing it with the ominous title, The Apocalypse Sod. He was so frightened that he encrypted his words, couching the route to the cave in obscure terms.
Can you recite it now? Give us an example?
Here is how it starts.
Bukalov formed a steeple of his fingers as he concentrated.
From Grichas Vel at Melkbosh Coil, bear 25 degrees for a distance of 289,182 krags. There you find what is hidden beneath the Boar's Head waterfall.
Harper didn't speak immediately. Tucker could almost feel the frustration coming through the speakerphone.
Does that mean anything to you?
Not a damned thing, Bukalov said. I tried for a solid week after finding this page. None of the locations are on any map. Not Grichas Vel, not Melkbosh Coil, not the Boar's Head Waterfall. And as far as I could ascertain, there is no unit of measurement called a krag.
Bukalov tossed his arms in the air.
It's one of the reasons I called out to you all. Surely you've got cryptographers and map experts who could decipher it. Get us on the right path to that cave.
I'll see what I can do, Harper said. Give me a couple of hours, let me do some research, and we'll reconvene here.
The line went dead. As they all headed out, Anya reached an arm toward Bukalov, clearly wanting to talk, to smooth matters between them. When he ignored her, Tucker read the pain in her face, the crush of her posture. She stood in the hall for a long breath, watching the man stalk off. When she turned away, he caught a glimpse of a single tear roll across a perfect cheekbone. It seemed betrayal wore many faces. 10:22 a.m.
Tucker used the break to walk Kane amid the courtyards of the embassy. He had been ordered not to venture beyond its gates.
The multi-level compound, with its industrial white walls and rows of cell-like windows, looked more like a maximum security prison than a consulate. Still, the small gardens inside were handsome, blooming with purplish-pink crocuses and tangled with roses. But best of all, the warm Turkish sun helped melt the residual Russian ice from his bones and thoughts. Even Kane had more of a dance to his step as he sniffed every corner and bush. But soon, Tucker was back inside, back at the conference table.
I may have a couple pieces of the puzzle worked out, Harper announced as she came back on the line. But I fear until we have boots on the ground in South Africa, the location of the cave will remain a mystery. From these obscure references, I believe de Klerk was trying to hide some meaning or significance that would only make sense to another Boer of his time.
Bukalov leaned closer.
Understandable. The Boer were notorious xenophobes, suspicious of other people and races, and especially paranoid about the British. But you said you had a couple of the clues solved. What did you learn?
It took consulting with a handful of Smithsonian historians, but we may have figured out de Klerk's reference to krag as a unit of measurement.
What is it?
Anya asked.
During the fighting back then, a common weapon used widely by Boer troops was a Norwegian rifle called an M1894 Krag Jorgensen. Over time, it became simply known as a krag. The rifle was 39 inches long. If we assume that was de Klerk's unit of measurement, the distance he described is around 178 miles.
Bukalov sat straighter, some of his normal spunk returning.
So, we now know the distance from Grisha's well to the Boar's Head waterfall.
And not much else, Harper added, quickly popping that balloon. I suspect the Boar's Head waterfall, where this cave is hidden, is not so much a name as what the place looks like, some local landmark that you have to see to recognize.
So obviously something that looks like the head of a boar, Tucker said.
And that's why we'll need boots on the ground. We need someone scouring that location, likely on foot or horseback, to view the place from the same vantage as de Klerk did in the past, Anya said.
Exactly.
Harper shifted the topic. But to even get there, we need to know where to start, where to set out from. Without that information, we're nowhere.
Bukalov nodded.
We must figure out what de Klerk meant by Grisha's well at the Melkbosh Coil.
Which brings me to the second piece of the puzzle we've solved. The historians determined that there was once a farm called Melkbosh Coil, owned by the Kluter family, located in the northern Cape province of South Africa. It's historically significant because the farmstead eventually prospered and grew into the present-day city of Sprengbok.
Then that's where we must go.
Bukalov slapped a palm on the table.
To Sprengbok, to find this Grisha's well. Then it's a simple matter to measure out the 178 miles at the compass bearing of 25 degrees, like de Klerk wrote, and look for this boar's head near a waterfall. That's where we'll find the cave.
Is that all we have to do? Tucker thought sourly. Harper also lacked the good doctor's confidence.
The only problem is I could find no reference to a place called Grisha's Well. It's likely a place known only to the locals of de Klerk's time. All we've been able to determine is that Grisha is Dutch for Wilma.
So then we're looking for Wilma's well, Tucker said.
That's about it, Harper conceded. Like I said, we need boots on the ground.
And I intend to be a pair of those boots, Bukalov said. My knowledge of de Klerk may prove the difference between success and failure out there.
Anya stirred too, clearly wanting to go. Like the doctor, she was also well-versed in de Klerk's work, and if anything, more stable.
Understood, Harper said. But all this presents one other problem.
Tucker didn't like the note of warning in her tone. Even her southern lilt grew heavier.
If you draw a line from Sprengbok along de Klerk's barren, it puts you squarely into the Groot Karas Mountains, in the country of Namibia.
Tucker took a deep breath and let it out audibly.
What? Anya asked. What's wrong?
Namibia is in the middle of a bloody war, Tucker explained, between government forces and guerrillas.
And those guerrillas, Harper added, hold those mountains. They're particularly fond of kidnapping foreigners and holding them for ransom.
Bukalov puffed loudly, clearly frustrated.
There has to be a way. We cannot abandon the search now.
We're not. But if you go, I wanted you to understand what you could be facing out there. I'll arrange some local assets to assist you in Africa, but it'll be far from safe.
Bukalov shook his head.
I must go. We must try, before Kharzin finds some other means to discover that cave. Utkin only saw that map page briefly before I burned it, but I don't know how much he retained or shared, and maybe I inadvertently mentioned something to him. I simply don't know.
Anya spoke with more certainty.
What I do know is that General Kharzin won't stop. Most everyone at the SVR detests him. He's a Cold War era warrior, a real dinosaur. He believes Russia's brightest days died with Stalin.
If Utkin has been feeding him intelligence all along, then he understands Luka's potential as a weapon. Properly introduced into an ecosystem like a rice paddy in Japan, a single speck of Luka would systematically destroy that ecosystem. And not just that rice paddy, but all of them.
That must not happen, Bukalov pressed.
I agree, Harper said. I'll begin making arrangements.
11:10 a.m. After settling some minor issues, Harper asked to speak to Tucker alone.
Have we made a devil's deal here, Tucker? Part of me thinks we should just firebomb this cave if we find it.
It may come down to that. But you've also made one hell of an assumption.
Which is what?
That Kane and I are going to Africa.
What? After everything we just discussed, you would consider bailing out?
Tucker chuckled. No, but a girl likes to be asked to the dance. Harper laughed in return.
Consider yourself asked. So what's your assessment of Anya and Bukalov? He plainly doesn't want her along.
I say that's his problem. Anya earned her place on this mission.
I agree. She seems to know almost as much about Luka as he does, and considering the stakes, it wouldn't hurt to have a different perspective on things. But the good doctor will not like it.
Tucker sighed. The sooner Bukalov learns that his tantrums will get him nowhere, the better it will be for everyone once he reaches the United States.
How soon can you get me a list of supplies you'll need?
A couple hours. I want to be underway tonight. In Springbok by noon.
Understood.
And I need to ask a couple of favors.
Name them.
First, find the family of that Beriev pilot, Elena. Make sure they know where to find her body and reimburse them for the Beriev.
And second,
make sure Utkin's body is returned to his family. They're in a village called Kalishkino on the Volga River.
Why? The man betrayed you, almost got you all killed.
But in the end, he saved us, and I respect that last act.
Naive or not, Tucker wanted to believe that maybe Anya was right, that Utkin had been forced against his will to betray them. But he would never know for sure, and maybe it was better that way. Sounds as though you liked him.
Harper's voice went unusually soft, as if sensing the depth of his regret. I suppose I did.
It's hard to explain. Thankfully, she let it go at that. Okay, I'll handle everything. But what about sending additional muscle your way, something beyond a few local assets?
I think small is better. Besides, Tucker had all the help he needed and trusted in the form of his four-legged partner.
You may be right, Harper agreed. South Africa's security agencies run a tight ship. You show up big and loud, and they'll be all over you.
I can't argue with that.
Now, I have to ask something difficult of you, she said.
Go ahead.
If you get to that cave and things go sour, you make damn sure Luka doesn't see the light of day, no matter the cost. All casualties.
Is that understood? Tucker inhaled deeply. I'll get it done. 3:34 p.m. A soft knock on his door woke him out of a light drowse. Kane lifted his head from Tucker's chest as the two lay sprawled on the bed, napping in the day's heat. Tucker, still in his clothes, rolled to his feet and placed his face in his hands.
Who the hell?
Kane hopped down, sidled to the door, and sniffed along the bottom. His tail began to wag. Someone he knew.
Tucker, are you awake?
A voice called through the door. Anya. He groaned, stepped over, and unlocked the door. He wiped his eyes blearily. What's wrong? Something better be wrong. Anya stood in the doorway, wearing a peach-colored sundress. She smoothed it over her hips self-consciously with her good hand.
One of the consulate wives gave it to me. I'm sorry. You were sleeping, weren't you?
She began to step away. No, it's all right. Come in.
I should probably be sleeping, too. But every time I lie down...
She walked over to the side chair across from the bed and sat down.
I'm frightened, Tucker.
Of going to South Africa?
Of course that, but mostly about what happens after all this, once we're in America.
Anya, the government will give you a new identity, a new place to live, and with your background, you'll have no trouble finding work. You'll be fine.
I'll be alone. Everything I know will be gone. Even Bukolov. You heard him. He'll barely talk to me now.
Maybe he'll calm down and eventually understand. She picked slightly at her cast, her voice growing pained.
He won't. I know him.
Tucker knew she was right. Bukolov was single-minded and emotionally inflexible. Now that he had DeClercq's diary in hand, Anya was no longer indispensable to his work. And in addition, she had proven herself untrustworthy. For Bukolov, both of these sins were unpardonable. Anya was right. Once in America, she would be alone, rudderless. She would need friends. With a sigh, he reached across and squeezed her hand. "You'll know at least one person in the States," he reassured her.
Kane thumped his tail.
"Make that two," he added.